Thanks, Bob.
Thanks.
Hi, my name's Rodney, an alcoholic.
Hey, Rodney!
I had my last drink on October the 9th, 1994. My sobriety date is September the 1st, 2004. Unfortunately, for me, I picked a sponsor that wouldn't allow me to smoke dope and pick up tokens in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's how that happened. Thank you all for inviting me to speak. It's I was thinking on the way here, you know, it's rainy, it's cold. Why am I coming out here? You know, I hadn't had a drink in a long time. Hadn't thought about drinking in a long time. I'm coming out here because David asked me to come out of here. And, I got to thinking, and, you know, the other reason I come out here is the same reason that Dr. Bob says he did it in the big book. You know, it's a sense of duty, you know, for me to repay Alcoholics Anonymous for the life that they've given me today. It's a pleasure. I enjoy it. You know, I enjoy coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't when I first started coming here, believe me. And, by doing so, I'm repaying my debt to the man who took the time to pass it on to me. And also, I'm taking out some insurance against a slip when I participate and actively stay involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and take the actions that I've been shown in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor, and my home group is the Joys of Recovery. We meet on Thursday nights over off of Providence Road in Chesapeake. And I met an old-timer one time over at the New Day group in Virginia Beach. And, you know, sometimes I'd go to meetings and just hear somebody share, or after the meeting, you just connect with certain people. You hit it off. Hey, man, I like what you had to say. And you exchange numbers. And so this guy, his name was Sid. And you know, we hit it off and we exchanged numbers. And we'd talk, you know, every couple weeks. He'd call me or I'd call him. And he was an elderly gentleman. And unfortunately, he got Alzheimer's. And I'd call him and I'd have to remind him who I was. And he's since passed away. And he said he was at a speaker meeting one time. And there was a guy on the front row sleeping. And the speaker said to the guy next to him, he says, "Hey, man, that guy next to you is sleeping. Why don't you wake him up?" And the guy looked up and said, "Why don't you wake him up? You put him to sleep." So, so it's my responsibility to wake you up if you go to sleep. Anyway, I was born, I'm going to be 57 years old a week from tomorrow. So I was born in 1967. And at DePaul Hospital in Norfolk, and I was to two loving parents. We were middle class, and I grew up. I actually grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised in Virginia Beach, over in the Kempsville area of Virginia Beach. So my mother and father always worked. I have three brothers. There were four boys. I was the third in line. So. I have an older brother that's 4 years older than me. I have a younger brother that's 4 years younger than me. And I have another brother, and we're 13 months apart. He's 13 months older than me. We were middle class, I would say. I didn't know, you know, I was middle class. I had everything I ever could have wanted. You know, for Christmas we got, you know, skateboards and, you know, the latest and greatest stuff. My parents worked hard to make sure that, you know, we were provided for, and we got the latest and greatest stuff, you know. And my mom and dad were married 57 years before my dad passed away in 2019. I would say out of six of my immediate family members, I would say that five of us may have drank alcoholically. You know, I have a couple brothers that are still out there, you know, doing whatever, doing the things I used to do before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll just leave it at that. I had my first drink when I was 13 years old. I was away. A buddy of mine snuck a beer from his dad's garage, and it's a pretty typical story in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went out and we drank one or two Miller High Lifes, and it did nothing to me, and it didn't taste very good. And so it struck my curiosity, and not shortly after that, we're talking about around 1980, we went on a vacation with some neighbors, and they had a place down in Carolina off the water, and they went out on the boat skiing, tubing, and whatnot, and my brother and I stayed back at the trailer, and there was some vodka there, and I decided that I was going to see what it really was like to get a buzz, you know, because I drank that Miller High Life, and it really didn't do anything to me. So I think I did about 7 shots of vodka. And I ended up being in a blackout. And so by the time they had come back off the boat, I left because I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And I hid under a car. I just hid under a car. And I could hear them calling me and looking for me. And finally I came out, and you know, I was wasted, and I got in a lot of trouble. And so really the first time that I drank to set out to get drunk, which I did every time after that, I ended up in a blackout. So I was a blackout drinker. So I had my first drink at 13, and for the next 14, 15 years, I hid behind alcohol and drug addiction, and that's what I did. I got kicked out of the school in 8th grade for selling stuff. My parents, when my daughter was, I was 13 years old, 14 years old, whatever. When my daughter turned 13 or 14, I thought to myself, man, I was just a child, got kicked out of school. It really hit me when I could really identify with that age when I had a child that age. I never drank for the taste. I always drank to get drunk. From day one, I set out to drink to feel different, like I fit in. I get in that ease and comfort place. And I remember when I was 15, there was a snowstorm out, and some friends of mine set out walking around the neighborhood, and one of them came out and they had a bottle of 151, and so we started drinking this 151, and the next thing I know, I'm in the back of my friend's Volkswagen, I'm throwing up, and getting a blackout. He's mad because I've destroyed his car. They get me to my parents' house and get me out of the car, bring me up to the porch, ring the doorbell, and haul freight. So my mom finds me laying there on the porch, throw up all over me. I got, freezing cold out. I got, long johns on, sweatpants on, corduroys on, layered up, for this expedition I was going on. And my mom got me cleaned up, and my dad, he was passed out in the chair, and nobody was the wiser, another night. I hung out with friends that drank. There were usually, friends that, they were a couple of years older than me, and every weekend, holiday, et cetera, that's what we did. We set out to party. We had a group of us, and we set out to party, I drove home many, many times from partying at the beach, at the oceanfront, various bars there, not knowing which way I came home when I woke up the next morning. I couldn't remember whether I took Princess Anne Road home or the interstate. And it was always a crapshoot when I left, because I didn't know, if they're going to have roadblocks or, what was going on, because, that's how they caught drunks on the road. I remember going to work. I'd ended up getting a job. My father was in the printing business, and I ended up getting a job. I had no clue what I wanted to do. I was college material right up until I, I, I was introduced to marijuana, you know, basically. And so I in high school, you know, I didn't have anything, I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. So I was able to get in this industrial cooperative training program. And the deal was, you went to school half a day and then, excuse me, you went to work the other half a day in the afternoon and you got graded for your work. And so I went to school in the morning and I got a job with my dad, same place he was working. The back of a print shop, went in there, they put me in the back and you know, gave me stuff to do. And so I kind of enjoyed it. You know, I was able to, you know, get out of school a half a day and then go to work where my dad's best friend was my boss. So I got good grades for work, you know. So that worked out really good. I remember, you know, we worked a lot of overtime when I went full time after I got out of high school. I took a month off. I graduated in 1985. You know, barely, certainly not to my potential. But I got out of there, I went into the work field, and I took a month off and I went to work, right, you know, I went to work full time for the printing firm. I remember getting sent home from work one Saturday. I was so hungover that the boss, I had a different boss at this time, he says, "Man, you are no use to me, whatever." I just had my head down. You know, I couldn't function. I was just, you know, so hungover. many times I would leave work after working all day down on West 27th Street in Norfolk. And some of you might know where that's at. And I would drive down 26th Street and I would take a right on Monticello Avenue. And I would swear on my way to work that I wasn't going to drink that day. That night, you know, it was a weeknight, and inevitably I would pull into the 7-Eleven on 26th Street at Monticello and get a 12-pack, and I would do that night after night after night after night, just telling myself I wasn't going to do it, you know. In the morning I wasn't going to do it, you know. So I started in the work field when I was 21. I met this girl at a party, and man, she was the best looking girl I've ever seen in my life, I swear. And I had to have her, you know, and that's trouble for me when I have to have something. So I got her, and I got her pregnant. We dated for a couple months, and she ended up moving away to Lynchburg when she said that you know, she was pregnant. And I didn't really, I didn't speak to her for about 4 or 5 months. I was still, you know, doing whatever I did, partying, drinking every day, you know, not really thinking about the consequences of my action and what this was going to involve in my life, and the responsibility. So, excuse me, one day she called out of the blue and said, you know, "Hey, I'd like to see you." And so I got my car and I drove to Lynchburg a couple weeks later. And, you know, on the way, I picked up, you know, a 12-pack because, you know, I had to get my head right before I could, you know, talk to her again, certainly. But anyway, we kind of patched things up and you know, we started... having a relationship, a long distance relationship. I was in Virginia Beach living with my parents. She was in Lynchburg. It's about three and a half hours. And so she called me one day, and actually her sister called me and said that she was going into labor. So I told my boss, I said, "Look, you know, he had known of the situation. I said, "Look, when this happens, I need to take some time off." So I left immediately when I got the phone call, and I drove to where she was living at the time in Bedford, Virginia. And on July 13th, 1989, I was blessed with a beautiful daughter. And I was 22 years old and full of maturity, I might add. I didn't have a clue. I was still doing what I knew how to do. And that was drinking, various other things. So in October of 1989, she moved back here, and we got a place over in Chesapeake, and we were going to make a run at this thing as a couple and a new baby. I moved out of my parents' house. We got an apartment over in Greenbrier, and I wasn't ready for all of that responsibility. And I continued to, in my selfish and self-centered ways, do what I did. And that was drink pretty much every day, and not do my part. And so in 1991, I went to work. My daughter was maybe not 2 years old yet. I can't remember the exact timing on this. Went over to a bar after work, was playing pool with some guys, set out to come home, and I got a DUI on Battlefield Boulevard. I was coming up off the 64 ramp, and I spun my car out, and then somebody hit me in the rear, blacked out, got a DUI. Got out of the car, threw all the beer cans over the overpass, sat there and waited because I didn't want to leave my nice car, and cops came and got a DUI. So the relationship with my daughter's mother and I lasted a few years, and maybe 3 years, and pretty soon she had kind of had enough. And she decided to leave, and I remember when we bought a house in Chesapeake prior to that, and I remember when she left, you know, I was devastated. She took my daughter, moved back to Bedford, which is 4 hours away west of here, and I, you know, I hit my knees and I was crying. I said, God, how could you possibly do this to me, you know, without ever thinking of my actions and my involvement and the consequences of my actions and my irresponsibility. So she moved away and struggled to maintain a relationship with her. While she was there, I was here. You know, I would go out there. And even when my daughter was born, before we moved in together, I knew exactly where I could stop at the convenience store and get four or five beers down before I could get to her dad's house where she was living at the time with my baby. I knew exactly, I could time it. So a couple of years go by and I'm still doing my thing and I'm trying to maintain this relationship. And then I was down at the oceanfront at a bar one night, Rogue's Gallery. And you know, we were drinking heavily and I was coming home on 264. I got pulled over and I got my second DUI. And I remember sitting in the back of the state trooper's car and I said out loud, man, this can't possibly be happening to me. And it was. So they took me down to the Chesapeake City Jail. And and so I got out of the jail there, the detox, and I was court ordered to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was devastating. Here I am tonight on my own free will, without a paper that needs to be signed. You know, and that was in 1994. So you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I went through the Chesapeake Substance Abuse Program. And I remember telling the counselor there, I would tell him, I said, look, you know, it's like I'm in this groove, man. You know, I want to stop, but I just can't stop. It's like over and over. I tell myself I'm not going to drink and use, but I drink and use anyway. And he said, doesn't sound like much of a groove to me, man. It sounds like a rut. And he had some recovery, you know. So anyway, so I go to some AA meetings over at the Serenity Lodge on Military Highway, and it was an old dry out hotel type place that, you know, the Ford plant and the major employers around here sent their people that were trying to get, you know, get them to stop drinking or using or whatever. And it was packed, you know. I mean, it was a room this big, and I mean, it was full, you know. And I was standing outside. There were so many people in there because I got there, at, you know, the, you know, 19 seconds before the meeting started, right, with my paper ready to get it signed. You know, that's why I was there. I needed to get my paper signed. So, you know, I would hear speakers, and you know, I'm telling the story tonight of, you know, when I was a newcomer, I'm the guy I hated, right? I'm the newcomer sitting there listening to this guy tell a story that I hated, right? Man, you're full of crap. You don't have X, you know. I hated it, you know. This AA thing, I don't know anything about it, you know, whatever. And, you know, what I realized is in 1994, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I told myself the two biggest lies that I believe that people can tell themselves in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is just my perspective, is that's one, I'm different. And two, I can do this by myself. That's what I told myself. And I believed it. And so that same year after I got the second DUI in 1994, you know, I got a, you know, I got the best attorney in town, and paid all the money, and you know, what he told me was, I can get your restricted license, and I can get your visitation set up to and from picking up your daughter, but if you get caught drinking and driving again, that's going to end. You will not be able to, you know, get this restricted license. So I had a restricted license to and from work, and to and from meeting my daughter's mother, ex-girlfriend, halfway between here and Bedford, Virginia, which is Crewe, Virginia. So it was 123 miles from my front door to where we met each way. So the arrangement was, we met on Friday night at 8 o'clock, and then we met again on Sunday because my daughter had to go to school, elementary school, you know, she was in school. On Sunday night again, we met at 5 o'clock. So every third weekend, we'd meet in Crewe, so I'd get visitation with my daughter. And we did this for 15 years. Every third weekend, I'd drive, and it was 512 miles in the weekend. So it was 123 there and back twice. And that's how I maintain a relationship with my daughter. Around this time in 1994, after hearing this from the attorney, get my second DUI, I was working at the same place. And I went out to Texas for some training for some electronic equipment. The latest and greatest electronic equipment that the company had purchased sent me out to Texas for some training. And I decided it was in Irving, Texas, or that area. I decided I'm close to Dallas. I need to go to Dallas, man. I ain't never going to come out here on vacation. I want to check it out. So I end up in Dallas in this honky-tonk bar. You know, I bought my cowboy boots with me so I'd fit in, and, you know, my Garth Brooks-looking shirt, you know, with the slipped silvery, you know, marble-looking buttons on it. And so I go to this place, you know, and I meet these girls from Oklahoma, you know, and we're having a great time. And I get just, you know, plastered drunk. And I get in a cab, and I go back to the hotel, and my boss at the time, he stayed there. He was on the straight and narrow. He'd never drank a drop in his life. And I get up the next morning, and I get on this flight back home, and man, I am miserable. You know, being hung over on an airplane is not fun. And not being able to drink. And I was, man, so hung over. And all these thoughts of what was going on in my life, and I was facing a second DUI. I was facing the possibility of losing my visitation with my four-year-old or so at the time, five-year-old. I said to myself on the airplane, I looked up and I said, God, I cannot live like this any longer. And I haven't drank since I said that prayer. But that's not my sobriety date. So I stopped, and that's what I did. I just stopped drinking. You know, I didn't go to AA anymore because I could do this by myself. That was different. I didn't need you people, whoever you were, because I didn't know you, but I didn't need you. when I did go to AA, what they told me was go to meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps, and stay out of relationships for the first year. That's what they told me. What I heard was stay out of relationships for the first year. See, my wife and I have, we play this game, what you said and what I heard. It works real good because I think there are a lot of communication issues in the world. Because sometimes what she says and what I hear are two different things. But that's what AA told me. That's what they told me. But what I heard was don't get in a relationship for a year, for the first year. So I marked it on my calendar, and day 366, I was out looking for this relationship that was going to fix me. Well, it just so happened that I picked up my next victim at work. My next hostage I grabbed from my employer. There was a girl that worked there, and she and I, you know, started dating, and she, somehow early on dating, she had a problem with the place she was living, and she came to my house, and she had gotten a fight with somebody that she was living with, a physical fight. I was living alone at the time. She came to my house and, you know, said, you know, she was over it, and she didn't have anywhere to go, and, you know, being the nice guy that I was, I let her stay at my house, you know, in my bed with me. So that was my next relationship, and, you know, we were together for, you know, I don't know, 6 years maybe, 7 years. And, you know, in my head, the next logical step was to get married, right? It's not because I was committed to her or I was, you know, in love with her deeply and I knew that she was the one above all others. It was the next logical step, you know, in my head. You know, I would just say, if you think it's the next logical step in that situation, it's probably not, you know. So we get married. And around 2002. So we get married and, you know, things are going well for about a year. And, you know, until I read it in the fifth step of the 12 and 12, there was always that mysterious barrier between myself and other people, especially in relationships. And it says, there was always that mysterious barrier that we could never surmount or understand. Why can't I get close to people and let people in? And I couldn't get close to her and let her in, you know? Because later on I found out, if she really knew me, she would run away. If she knew what I did, what I was thinking, if she knew me, she'd run away. And then my biggest fears would be exposed, rejection and abandonment. You know, because I'm deathly afraid of being alone. Because I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to be alone. I'd rather every day, all day long, for my entire life, to be in the wrong relationship than be alone. That's the way... That's my alcoholism, you know. It says in the book, alcoholics are tortured by loneliness. We don't want to be alone. So it wasn't long after that that she decided that she didn't want to be married anymore. and she ran off with a guy at work. And I was devastated. I was devastated. Like, I had never been emotionally broken like that in my life. And before, what I found out was I always wanted something out of relationships that I was incapable of giving. And before she ran off, Things were just odd. There was a little period where things were odd, and I knew something was up, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So we were down on the Outer Banks with some friends of mine, and, you know, they start smoking weed, and the next thing I know, you know, she and I are smoking weed, and, you know, then I get home, and I'm buying weed, and it had been 10 years since I had, you know, done any of that, you know. I had stopped in 1994, and so the weed didn't fix the marriage, you know. I'm not sure what I set out to do, but I was willing to go to any length at that point. The weed didn't fix it. So my marriage failed. And so now I'm alone again. My biggest fear is back. I'm alone. I've been rejected, abandoned, and I'm alone. So I didn't know what to do. And this is not, this is part of my story. A fairly amazing part, actually. I was driving by the meeting before it was a meeting where we meet on Providence Road, and there was a church. And I had driven by that church thousands of times, literally, in my life. I mean, it was on my route, you know, in a common place. And I was broken enough. I drove into that church parking lot one night, and I knocked on the door. And a man came out, and he opened up the door, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yes, I think you can." And he said, "Well, come on," and he introduced himself as a pastor of the church. And I let him know what was going on in my life. And he prayed with me, and we did some other things, and I stayed there about an hour or so. In the meantime, I had started going to AA again. I'll get back to that. But anyway, after I was getting ready to leave that night, that I drove into that church and met Pastor Ken Barnes over there, I was walking to the set of doors like that led to the outside, the double doors with the push handle on them. And I got ready to push the handle, and I pushed and opened the doors, and he said, he was at the end of the hall, and he said, "Hey, Rodney." And I said, "Yeah, Pastor Ken." He said, "I want to tell you something." I said, "What's that?" He said, "I hadn't been here working on a Tuesday night in over 3 years." He said, "But tonight was the night that you were supposed to walk through those doors." You know, a little bit of light came on in my life that night. And I started at the same time. I was just early on going back to AA because I wanted to fix my marriage, and my ex-wife was, we were going to two different counselors, and I said, "Well, this is not going to work. We got to go to the same counselor, you know." So we go to the same counselor, and I'm in enough pain, you know, and I start to get honest, and I tell the counselor, you know, "I have a history of alcohol and drug abuse." And she says, and I told her I had gone to AA, and I got a couple DUIs and so forth. And she says, "Well, I think you should go back to AA and take the suggestions." And I thought, "You bitch." And so I went back to AA, and I took my mom, because she had a drinking problem at the time. So I took my mom to AA, because I didn't want to go back. I mean, I had 10 years, man. I'm picking up a 10-year chip, man, you know. Just smoked a bag of weed a couple days ago, but I'm going to get that 10-year chip. So I took my mom, because she was drinking a lot at the time. So I actually gave her my original big book, this one right here, my third edition. You know, I got an AA, and when I came to AA, they were using the third edition big book. When I got a sponsor, they were using the fourth edition, you know? That sometimes slowly part was written about me, I think. You know? And so I gave my mom my original big book, third edition. And I carry that with me because there's a lot of things that people in the program have given me in here, and there's an inscription in that book that holds a lot of importance in my recovery. And so I started going to AA, and and during this time, you know, alcoholism never crossed my mind. I never thought that I was an alcoholic. I mean, after all, I hadn't drank in 10 years. I couldn't quite possibly be an alcoholic, you know? And so I was trying to make this marriage work, and I was coming to AA, and at some point, I drew the line on the relationship with my ex-wife. I got an AA, and I did the unthinkable. I asked the guy to sponsor me. Absolutely unthinkable. I don't ask for help. And I come from a family of men, you know. We don't ask for help. As Earl H. says, all we talk about is our genitals and our wallets, and we lie about both. We don't ask for help. I asked this guy to sponsor me. He looked nothing like me. He had two sleeves of tattoos. He had these glasses on, you know. But I heard what he said. He said he had been in and out of 13 treatment centers and nothing worked. He was living in his parents' basement, making $100,000 a year, working for Ford Motor Company, all the overtime he could do. And he was broke, and he was unhappy, and he was addicted, and he was drunk. And nothing worked until he got a sponsor and worked the steps. And all he wanted to be was happy. And at that time, that sounded pretty good to me. Happiness sounded pretty good to me. So I asked him to sponsor me. So he gives me one of these cards that they used to have in meetings, and he writes his name on it. And he writes Scott Jones, and he puts his phone number on there. Well, his last name wasn't Jones. He said, man, you were so crazy, I wasn't going to give you my real name. He said, man, I didn't want you to know my real name, you know. And he said, here's what I need you to do. If I'm going to work with you, we're going to work the steps. I need you to get a home group. I need you to get two service commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need you to read 2 pages of the big book every day on the step we're on only. I need you to get involved. I need you to show up 20 minutes early for the meeting, and I need you to stay 20 minutes after the meeting. I need you to find newcomers and give them rides. And he said, I need you to get 2 service commitments. And I thought, all right. So he said, we got one open at this meeting. Make coffee for 6 months. And again, like Earl H. says, the hell I am. I don't know these people. I don't know how making coffee is going to help me. You know, I'm here. I need help. Making coffee for strangers don't look like a solution to me. So anyway, he asked me if I was willing to go to any length. And I said, yeah, and I didn't know what the hell that meant. And so I started making coffee. And I surrendered on the relationship. I said, look, you know, we got into the steps. And he got me to chair in meetings, you know, got me involved in service work. So I was chairing a meeting. And ended up starting to go to this church that I walked into. And became a member of the church. Started to go on Sundays by myself. You know, many Sundays I was in there crying, you know, my life's falling apart, my wife left me, blah, 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 now I'm an alcoholic, who the hell would want me, you know, all that stuff. And had a spiritual experience in that church. I was crying. It was right when my marriage was falling apart. I was early on in AA. I didn't know what to do. I was broken. And I felt like something held my right hand, and it kind of freaked me out, you know. Like, wow, you know, I don't know what's real, what's not real. You know, I always believed in God as a kid, and I believed I was going to hell, you know, because I was raised in a Pentecostal church. And if you drank and you smoke, you were going to hell, right? And then, of course, on the flip side, my mom was Catholic. We'd go to her church, and the priest would be out there drinking and smoking. So, you know, I wonder why I was confused. So anyway, I had this spiritual, you know, experience. I'm chairing a meeting. On Sunday, I had a spiritual experience. I'm chairing a meeting out in Great Bridge. I walk into the meeting. I'm setting up by myself. I got the key, blah, blah, blah. Alcoholics Anonymous is great. It's where the black sheep of the family, the drug addict alcoholic, gets the key to the church. You know? Think about it, right? That's a miracle, right? So I get the key to the church. I open the church. I'm walking down the hallway in the church, and I look up, and there's a scripture on the wall. And it's Isaiah 41:13, and it says, I am the Lord thy God, I will take thy right hand, and I will help thee. And I thought, wow, man, there might be something to this God thing, this AA thing. Perhaps I'm supposed to be chairing this meeting tonight. You know, because I ask God to make it real clear, write it in the sky, and he does, you know. And then I wonder if it's real. So, you know, that's something that just kind of blew me away. So went to a lot of meetings, called my sponsor every day. We set a time for me to call. We went to a lot of meetings because he got in an accident and lost his license for 5 years. He injured some people pretty bad in Michigan. So he was, you know, didn't have a license. So I would pick him up and we'd go to a lot of meetings and a lot of stuff happened. And I remember one time, you know, I was, you know, you don't get rigorously honest all at one time, you know. I mean, you got to withhold a little bit, you know. And so I started to trust him, and we're riding down the road one night, and I was like, hey, man, I got something to tell you. And he would always say, oh, boy. And I said, man, I hadn't had a drink in 10 years, but, you know, 6 months ago or whatever, I smoked some pot with my estranged wife. And he was like, really? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, man, here's what I need you to do. And I was real excited. And he said, the next time at the end of the meeting that they say anybody with a year or more sobriety, raise their hand, don't raise your hand anymore. Pick up a white chip, reset your clock, and give your 10-year chip back. And I was like, damn, man, you're kind of tough. Kind of tough on me, man. So I did all that. He took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. Because when I drank, things happened that I didn't plan on happening, you know? I knew that when I got to step two, came to believe the power greater than me, greater than ourselves, could restore sanity. How I got that step was I was forthcoming with information, right? He was at my sounding board. I would say, hey, man, here's what's going on, and here's what I'm thinking about doing about it. And he would say, don't do that, man. Work the steps. That situation will take care of itself, you know? And when I start running my cuckoo ideas by somebody, they become real. And I realize that insanity that is going on in my head is real. And that's the insane, you know, that's where I need to be restored to sanity. So we get to step three, made a decision to turn my life over to the care of God as I understood him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us, the power to carry that out. I thought I was afraid to take this, right? Because at the time I had this condemning God and I was going to hell. Like so it's kind of a contradiction. So I'm turning my will and my life over to care of somebody who's going to send me to hell. You know, I don't know if I want to do that. That doesn't seem like a good idea to me. So the other thing is I got to stop stealing if I do this. That's what's going on in my head. So I do it anyway. We get down on our knees. He says, basically, you know, we get down on our knees in the church. We say the third step prayer together. And he says, tonight, he showed me how to do an inventory. I did a few inventories. Got the practice down. We said the third step prayer. That same night I went home, started working on my searching fearless moral inventory, step four. I worked on that. It was great. There was nobody in my life. I didn't have to worry about anybody finding it, you know, because I'd run everybody off. I was living by myself. I go to a meeting, go home, work on my inventory. Go to a meeting, go home, work on my inventory. I did that for, I don't know, a long time. One day at a time, 1 hour at a time at night, you know, I did it. I'd call him and say, man, I can't do this. I'd call him on the phone crying. I can't write this stuff down, man. I can't do it. It's stuff that I thought. I can't write it down. And he says, man, you're getting ahead of yourself. He said, you're on your fifth step. We're on the fourth step. Nobody says you got to tell it to me, you know. Just write it down. That's all we're doing right now. We're just writing it down. You know, because I know how to live in tomorrow and yesterday, but I didn't know how to live in today. I get through the fourth step, and I call him, and I said, hey, man, I think I'm done with my fourth step. And he says, nah, probably not, man. He says, why don't you just, you know, chill out and take it easy, and, you know, for an hour a night, just sit down and, you know, think if anything else comes to you. And, you know, I did, you know, three-column inventory, resentment, fear, and sex, people, places, institutions. I did the inventory, and finally I was done with it. Did the fifth step with him, 2 hours at a time, met at his house, did the fifth step. I left nothing out of my fourth step. Nothing. Nothing that I could think of. All the, every dark cranny, every twist of character, just like it says in the 12 and 12. You know, put all the bad stuff at the bottom of the pile, you know. Eventually we got to the bottom of the pile, you know. So we do this get through my fifth step, get step 6 and 7, you know, work on step 6 and 7. The engines of the program where the rubber meets the road. Get to step 8, made a list. All persons I had harmed became willing to make amends to them all. I had the list in my fourth step, pulled out my fourth step. We go through it, figure out which ones I'm going to make, which ones I'm not going to make. And I start making amends. My immediate family. I made an amends to a woman that lived in my parents' neighborhood. I'd stole her purse when I was in my active addiction. So that was the one I needed to make. Went up and knocked on her door. I hadn't seen these people in probably 25 years maybe. They didn't know who I was when I knocked on the door. But when I introduced myself, they knew. I made my amends to this lady. I said, look, you know, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm trying to straighten out my life. I did something that I'm not proud of, and I'd like to ask you to forgive me. And I told her I stole her purse. And I said, if there's anything I can do to make it right, please let me know. I'm willing to do it. Whatever. And I shut up and I let her tell me. And she said, you know, if I could get that back, there were some pictures in there that I'd really like to have back, but I know they're long gone. And I forgive you. And she said, if you could do anything for me, I wish you could help my son. He's in prison with alcohol and drug convictions. You know, he's an addict and an alcoholic. And if there's anything you can do, you know, I wish you could help him. I said, well, here's my phone number. If he ever gets out or if he ever wants help, I'll put him in touch with some people that might be able to help. And before I left, she said, you come back and visit me anytime. She said, matter of fact, I'd like to see you. You come back and anytime, you're welcome here. And so I did that. My ninth step, my tenth step, you know, taking daily inventory. I knew how to do that because I'd done a four step, take daily inventory. 11th step, I was already doing that by the time I got to it, you know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. The 12th step, I was involved in service work from early on, you know. I had a spiritual awakening as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And doing so, you know, I tried to carry the message. That's what I'm doing here tonight. Move ahead a few years in 2008. I met a girl I didn't even want to go on a date with her. I thought it was a bad idea. It was bad for business. It was I'm in sales, and it was my largest account, and I knew if it went south, I'd lose a lot of business. So the risk wasn't worth the reward to me. I did it anyway, and so we went on a date, and we went on another date, and pretty soon we knew that we were you know, meant to be together in a very short period of time, actually. So I met her in 2008, and we got married in 2012, and I did things like I would have never done before I worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I asked her dad if I could marry her, you know. I would have never done that, you know. Just not something that would have crossed my mind, because I'm selfish and self-centered at my core, you know. It didn't matter whether I had his approval or not, you know. I did things like that, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to do, you know, be honest and open and willing. And, of course, he said yes, he said, as long as you don't ever raise your hand to her, you know, basically hit her. And I told him recently, that's been difficult, but I've done it, man. Not really. We have a great relationship. We got married in 2012. In 2013, you know, she was 32 when we met, and she said she had never had any children, and she said, you know, I'd always wanted to have a child, and I never had any children, and I said, well, you know, I would be open to that, you know, if it's meant to be. And, you know, we had that conversation before we got married, you know. I didn't wait to marry her and then hold her hostage, you know, said, I don't want a kid, you know. That's stuff that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, have that conversation up front. Because if I didn't want the kid and she did, there's no sense in me getting married and holding her hostage. Give her an opportunity. It's not all about me. But anyway, so in 2013, we had a little boy. And he's 10 years old now. And so I have a 34-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son, you know, and that's just the way it is, you know. I'm not going to apologize for it. It's great, you know. It keeps me young, you know. My 10-year-old son, you know, he don't let the old man in, you know. And I'm going to wrap it up, but there's one thing that resonates with me that's out of the Hazleton book, and it's January 6th, and it's very important, and I hope I'll leave you with this. January 6th, AA thought for the day. Keeping sober is the most important thing in my life. The most important decision I ever made was my decision to give up drinking. I am convinced that my whole life depends on not taking that first drink. Nothing in the world is important to me as my own sobriety. Everything I have, my whole life, depends on that one thing. Can I afford ever to forget this, even for 1 minute? Thank you.